listening to this amazing story again as we go to press, I had to take a deep breath. Does this case discussion encourage the use of alternative treatments of unproven value and perhaps put patients at physical risk? Perhaps we'll receive a few emails from individuals with these concerns, and I wonder what our responsibility is as an education group in terms of these controversial issues. Then I think about the fact that maybe even if the vitamin C in this situation is a placebo, there might be a real medicinal value, sort of as a placebo effect, as discussed by Dr. Vanook. But it feels right to bring this case to you for your consideration, so there it is. The second patient cared for by Dr. Vanook and Mr. Weber is a 65-year-old dentist who was diagnosed 3 years ago with a stage 3 colon cancer with 4 positive lymph nodes. The patient received adjuvant therapy with FOLFOX and has no evidence of cancer recurrence at this time. This case emphasizes the critical and very challenging role of patient education in the adjuvant setting. And to begin, Dr. Vanook provided an overview of the case.
This is an example of a sophisticated patient. He's a dentist who lived almost 100 miles away and was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer and made the decision with his family to get treated at the major medical center, to come to the academic center, even though this was standard therapy. And his judgment when we met the first time was, in balancing the risks and benefits, he had no doubt about taking FOLFOX, but as a dentist, he was very concerned about neuropathy and about how that could impact his livelihood. And I think part of his decision was based on having more confidence that we at the academic center would be more tuned in to his neuropathy. I'm not sure that's true, but that was the genesis. So to do this, of course, is quite complex. We had to check labs the day before at a community laboratory and fax the results. A lot of moving parts, a huge investment on his part to get care, and frankly, a huge investment on the nurse's part, who brokered every step of the way, checking his labs, making sure he should make the trip. So this was an example where there was no debate about the therapy, although we did talk briefly about the small risk that people on FOLFOX will develop neuropathy very early that doesn't go away. We did put out on the table that capecitabine might be an alternative, but he quickly dismissed that and, again, made the determination that for his peace of mind and his wife's peace of mind, he would get his care with us. And he, like clockwork, came down regularly for treatment. We had to make some dose adjustments. It's a good example of when care goes well with a coordinated program and with an excellent infusion center and with a superb nurse practitioner. I literally probably saw this patient 2 or 3 times during the course of the 6 months.
As you initially evaluated him, what was your assessment in terms of what his risk of recurrence would be without any kind of systemic therapy and how that might be affected by receiving systemic therapy?
Right. So we're learning more and more how to subtype or subclassify patients with stage 3 colon cancer. They're not all created equal. So the major important issue is more than 4 or more lymph nodes involved or less. Given his case, I thought his risk of relapse was in the 55% to 60% range, as opposed to maybe less if there had just been, let's say, 1 lymph node. So part of it is trying to parse out really what the difference is. I think generically for all stage 3 patients, the incremental benefit of chemotherapy is substantial with FOLFOX, accrues to all patients across no matter how many lymph nodes are involved. So in his case, there was very little debate about the fact that FOLFOX represented the go-to therapy.
Now, what would you estimate? You're saying baseline he'd have a 55-60%, you know, roughly, chance of cancer recurrence. How do you think it would be affected by receiving FOLFOX?
I think we improved that by about 20 absolute percent. So I think we put him into the 2 out of 3 category. Clearly, what we'd like to do, it's interesting that there's a lot of energy into stage 2 patients to look at genome profiling to determine whether patients stand to benefit or not from chemotherapy. Lost in the shuffle is that we should probably be doing that in stage 3 patients to figure out incrementally what the degree of benefit is going to be.
And I guess in terms of genomic profiling, we have the example in breast cancer of the Oncotype DX assay that now has become really a standard or frequently used in breast cancer. Initially, that was looked at in the node negative situation, but now they have data in node positive. And it's kind of this idea of finding tumors that are biologically going to improve with chemo versus not. Is that the same kind of thinking in colon?
Absolutely right. And I think it's quite probable that we would figure out, if we can put enough effort into it and have enough time, who needs oxaliplatin and who may not need oxaliplatin.
One of the things we found in our most recent survey that just got submitted to the GI symposium was that a lot of these people, most of them actually say they were offered specific numbers about risk of recurrence with and without adjuvant therapy. It seems like that's something that's kind of becoming standard in colon cancers. Do you generally offer numbers to your patients?
Well, it's interesting. I tend to be broader and offer range much more than numbers. But it is the case that some of these online tools which give numbers lead many oncologists to give numbers, which I worry are more precise than we can really be. But it is true that patients really appreciate the numbers, and it makes it more black and white for them.
So when I spoke with this man, one of the things that he told me that I thought was interesting was that he was very reluctant to take adjuvant therapy, even after he spoke with you. And I guess it was discussions with his family, and almost sounded like the family almost was like kind of pressuring him to take therapy.
Well, this is not an unusual dynamic where the spouse or the kids really are crystal clear on what needs to be done. And of course, you've got a patient who just had an operation, whose life just got turned upside down. And so he's not feeling well. He's missing part of his colon. And now he's facing 6 months of chemotherapy. And there remains the part myth and part reality that chemotherapy is not pleasant. And you then shower the patient with the risks associated with it, a small risk of dying from chemotherapy. So the truth is, while there's a great range, many patients initially say, well, they don't want chemotherapy. Part of it is the family influence. Part of it is as they recover from the surgery, they start to get their vitality back and they're more willing to do it. So he's not unusual. And it's also often the case, I find, that the medically sophisticated patients may be also hesitant, although they come in different shapes and sizes. Some medically sophisticated patients do everything and have just scoured the internet. And yet others who have had a different perspective might say, well, I've seen patients suffer, I've seen things go bad. So there is variability. But yeah, this was a patient who wasn't clear on his first visit whether he would do it.
And he actually also told me that it was his thinking that he didn't want to do a whole lot of research on this, that he was kind of relying on you. And although he does identify himself as a healthcare professional, therefore maybe more knowledgeable of this whole arena, but he didn't seem like he wanted to go out and get a whole lot of information on it.
And I think that's also more commonly the dynamic. People who, even the medically savvy or the internet savvy people, let somebody else sift through the internet and do their homework. And it's interesting, there are people like that.
So I asked him what was his impression in terms of what his risk was of having a cancer relapse without any systemic therapy and how that might be affected by him taking the FOLFOX. What do you think he said?
50-50 up to 75%.
He said 50-50 up to 95%.
Well, so he didn't get that from me or from my nurse practitioner.
But I think it's interesting that he has that impression. I certainly didn't say anything about it. And as you say, we don't really know exactly what the number is, but ballpark, I think he's a little bit thinking it's good. And we found that in our survey too, that even though patients remembered getting numbers, when we asked them what those numbers were, it didn't seem like it was a lot of what I just said to you, 95, almost curing me.
Right. Now, it may be part of the extrapolation. So it is true that numerically your odds get better and better since the predominant time of relapse, but certainly that 95 is on the extremely high side. And wonderful guy, I sure hope he's right. But one of the reasons I give ranges rather than numbers is I believe people, even with ranges, they tend to stick in their mind which of the two numbers they want to remember. So it's a very complex discussion.
Right. And I guess the other thing which you alluded to is this issue of if a cancer recurrence is going to happen, when is it going to happen? We know, again, in breast cancer, in the last few years, there's been a lot more awareness that these patients have delayed recurrences, particularly the ER-positive tumors. ER-negative, once the patient gets 3-4 years out, the chance of recurrence is much less. From what I've seen, it seems like colon cancer falls into that latter category where most, but I guess not everyone, but the vast majority of the recurrences occur in the first 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, it's said that 90 to 95% of recurrences occur in the first 2 or 3 years. Now, with the caveat that FOLFOX is pretty new on the scene, and let's say, for instance, if the studies show that FOLFOX Avastin improves outcome, we may be delaying recurrences rather than eliminating recurrences. So that could change, but that's right now what we cite.
Let's bring up the issue you mentioned before of the stage 2 patient. This man had positive nodes. If he had had negative nodes, how would you have thought through the choice in that situation?
So the high risk factors, depending, there are certain factors that are clearly agreed upon: obstruction, perforation, extension to a local structure, or inadequate sampling of nodes. Anywhere between 12 and 14 nodes is felt to be the necessary requirement to truly be node negative. Arguably, a patient who has fewer than 12 nodes sampled is going to be an NX patient and isn't really a stage 2. So those are high-risk features. Other people would argue that lymphovascular invasion or poorly differentiated tumors, which are very infrequent in colon cancer, I'm not convinced that those tilt the scale towards poorer prognosis, but I think in such a nuanced decision, many patients are looking for anything to tip the scales, and those are the kinds of things that might do it.
What are the things that you say to patients who are about to begin on adjuvant therapy in terms of what to expect in terms of side effects and risk? Let's talk about the most common regimen, which is FOLFOX, which is what this man received.
Right. So I tell them that it's very likely that they'll be able to work and maintain an almost normal existence during the treatment, but that they need to be prepared that they won't be able to. That, for example, FOLFOX, which requires an infusion pump, we orient them with our nurses, what it's going to be, what the limitations are, how many visits to the center. But I basically tell them that, in my view, probably a third of patients have virtually no side effects to speak of, at least through the first 3 to 4 months. A third of patients have modest side effects that require some alterations. And then a third of patients really either have post-treatment nausea or fatigue or severe cold sensitivity that actually truly interferes with their day-to-day functioning.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you explain in terms of both the cold sensitivity as well as the peripheral neuropathy in terms of what's going on and, you know, how to deal with it?
Both of these are thought to be calcium channel interference by oxaliplatin, although the mechanism is not well understood. The cold sensitivity is a nuisance, so it doesn't lead to any substantial problems down the road, but the way we explain it is if you chew on ice, it's going to really be painful. If you put your hands in the refrigerator, it's going to be painful. If you go skiing, you will have pain. For some people, it's just the day of treatment. Others, it may be for days. And we do routinely use calcium and magnesium, although I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But calcium and magnesium, in my experience, all but eliminates the cold sensitivity in many patients.
So do you wait and see if they have it?
So I used to wait. If patients complained that they really were bothered by cold sensitivity, we would use calcium and magnesium. It adds a couple of hours in the chair on the day of oxaliplatin. It adds some expense. And then there was a period of time where we were concerned, based on an early interim analysis of ongoing studies assessing the value of calcium and magnesium, that it might have led to an inferior outcome. in patients with advanced colon cancer. It's an interesting dilemma. It turns out that data really doesn't pan out, and calcium and magnesium did not interfere with efficacy. So we do use it for severe cold sensitivity. The use of it based on these studies that were closed early nonetheless suggested that there was less cumulative peripheral neuropathy, which is different than cold sensitivity. And so we're struggling with whether to routinely use calcium and magnesium to diminish that risk. My current approach, though, and where I count on my nurse and the reporting of the patient, and one of the things we emphasize in our visits with patients getting FOLFOX, is we need them to be totally forthright in terms of what their symptoms are and how they're doing. After 6 or 7 cycles, they will often develop residual neuropathy that persists during the course of the 14 days. And my rule of thumb, if they have any persistent neuropathy at the time of the next treatment, at the most, we dose reduce. And I'll, depending if they're 6, 7 cycles in, I might even eliminate the oxaliplatin altogether.
What are some of the variations in what people report to you in terms of qualitatively the types of peripheral neuropathy they have, the symptoms they have? What kinds of reports will get you to be more concerned than others?
This is a function of the, for lack of a better word, sophistication of the patient or their ability to explain. Some people are amazingly in touch with their body and can be precise in distinguishing cold sensitivity from tingling. What I look for in particular, I think one of the earliest signs of oxaliplatin toxicity that's worrisome is people, when you query them, they have trouble walking in the dark because they don't know where their feet are. And I've seen this routinely in patients who poo-poo the significance of the neuropathy. And yet when you ask them, they'll say, you know, it's true, I need to put the light on when I get up to go to the bathroom at night because I'm worried about walking. And I think those are subtle findings. The problem is we don't have good uniform test capability to understand who's really developing neuropathy and who isn't.
Now, is this usually just numbness, or are there also dysesthesias?
Yeah, there can be burning and tingling, and different people, depends on what they do. So the patient who's surfing the internet all the time, often the first thing they'll say is that their typing on the keyboard has changed. They notice a different strike, or they're double when they hit the keyboard. One patient said every time they hit the I, they had double I's. It's a little lag time on that finger on the keyboard.
What about motor problems, difficulty buttoning buttons or squeezing?
Right. That almost always is downstream, and I believe we've screwed up. We've not been attentive enough, or the patient hasn't been forthcoming, because that should be the exceptional patient who's fine one day, gets the next dose of oxali, and then can't button their buttons. But those are showstoppers for sure.
So once there's any kind of motor problem, you're going to stop treatment?
I do.
Now, when you encounter these kinds of problems, do you generally completely stop the oxali? Do you decrease the dose? Do you bring it back?
Some of that depends on where in the cycle they are. So while it's imperfect, what I look at, the C07, the NSABP study that looked at FLOX, a different way of giving oxaliplatin, they showed that fewer doses of oxaliplatin appeared to yield the same net benefit in terms of survival from colon cancer. So my belief is this is not proven, and there is a study that's planned that will compare 6 to 12 cycles of FOLFOX. My belief is if you get 7 or 8 cycles of FOLFOX in, I'm a believer, and I generally stop the oxaliplatin rather than dose reduce. If they're having some evidence of neuropathy earlier, I would cut the dose.
Now, in general, what do you see once people have stopped FOLFOX in terms of how they feel, their energy levels, and how long does it take them to kind of get back to where they were before?
I think it takes 4 to 6 months for patients to really get back, and many will have lingering neurotoxicity for a year, 18 months. A few patients, it never goes away. And a few patients get neurotoxicity after they may not have had much of it during this treatment, and then it gets worse, whether that's a concomitant medication. One of the things I've observed in a handful of patients who, let's say, had a need for anesthesia, in a few cases, takedown of a diverting colostomy, it's fascinating, but you wonder if the anesthesia doesn't exacerbate the neuropathy. because we've seen a number of patients who suddenly develop worsening neuropathy after FOLFOX and after an anesthesia intervention. Mechanistically, don't understand. Other people have commented on the same finding. Maybe some neuromuscular blockade used for anesthesia that makes some difference.